Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
On this episode of Real Talk, we have Warren Dahan, the co-CEO of Acor Capital. Acor is one of the largest non-bank private lenders in our industry, with $21 billion under management and 120 employees. They do transitional bridge loans across all asset classes, senior loans, mezz loans, preferred equity. In our conversation, you will see why I consider, and many consider, Warren one of the smartest individuals in our industry. He, in almost a professorial way, speaks about a lot of the macro changes, challenges that are facing our industry, but he can also get into the micro aspect of our business. I've seen him firsthand speak about monetary policy, and in the same conversation, roll up his sleeves and go through operating budgets and renovations on multifamily value add deals. It's a treat to have Warren on, and I'm sure you will enjoy this conversation, albeit a sobering view of our real estate industry and the market in general. Hello, welcome to another edition of Real Talk. I'm here with my good friend, Warren Dahan, co-CEO of Acor Capital. Warren, how you doing?
I'm good. Good, Andrew. Nice to be here with you guys today.
Well, I appreciate it. I know you're in the middle of transit from New York to Miami, and you're holed up in a conference center in the airport. So I appreciate you making the time. So Warren, let's just start to the extent I think all of my audience should know about Acor, but in case there are a few that don't, why don't you tell us what Acor is?
Well, Andrew, look, Acor Capital is, we're one of the largest non-bank lenders in the country. We started the company in 2015, and we've grown it to about $21 billion in, under management today. And we have about 120 people in 5 offices. And all we do is make transitional commercial real estate loans. We try and pick the top quartile markets, the top quartile borrowers, and the top quartile real estate across all product types, and make bridge loans, first mortgages, mezzanine, and preferred equity. And we have various vehicles, those that do the senior debt and others that do more high yield in commercial real estate.
That's a great overview. I mean, look, $21 billion from 2015 to 2023, you guys know how to raise money and know how to put out money. And so let's just get right into it about today's market. It's the number one topic on my podcast and in just in talking in general, right? Day in and day out. So how do you view just today's market, and is Acor, you know, what's your sentiment of putting out money today?
I mean, our first, the overall view has to be one of great caution and concern. You know, we're a lender. Our job is to, as a fiduciary, is to get our principal back and to earn our interest. That's our primary objective. So we're not in the hope business. We're not in the dreaming business. We're simply in the business where we deploy capital, we invest it. We make loans that are secured by first mortgages or mezzanine pledges to great borrowers and great pieces of real estate that are going through transition, whether it's ground up construction or whether it's light rehab or heavy rehab. And we are positioned really as the borrower's partner in finance. So the vision for the company really is to be the financier to the commercial real estate industry. So always be there with liquidity to be able to provide different products. So talking about the market today, a good friend of mine called me the other day and he said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could just go a few months without a generational change in the markets? And I think that was really well said, because it feels like we've gone through multiple generational changes in the period of 6 months. People often ask me how this is different to COVID. And, you know, COVID to me, the analogy I use is it was sort of like a great athlete, very fit, ran marathons, had a heart attack, but recovered very quickly. And obviously with $7 trillion of stimulus getting pumped into the system, it was easy for that athlete to get his or her feet under her again. Today feels very different. It feels like the athlete smokes too many cigarettes, maybe Marlboro Light, maybe breaks off the filter and smokes it raw, and drinks a lot of scotch and has a heart attack. So the distribution—
Are you talking about any particular clients of mine or just this imaginative figure?
I think you can answer that question.
Okay.
But I, you know, so the distribution of outcomes or the variability in the outcomes coming out of this are broad. And, you know, I remember 6 months ago, people asking me, well, how does this time compare to 2008, 1998, 1992? And the natural answer was, in 2008, we had a bank crisis. We had a leverage crisis. Everybody was overleveraged, the borrowers, the banks, everybody was too much leverage in the system. And we created as a result. I would have given a very similar answer 6 months ago. And one of the lessons learned there is that while we are all pretty tied into the markets, broadly speaking, we didn't quite know what the impact of high interest rates was going to be across all sectors. And I would proffer up to say that we still don't know exactly what the impact of high interest rates is going to be. Clearly, interest rate sensitive products like real estate, as an example, with leverage, are susceptible from a valuation perspective to higher interest rates. We all understand that. What we didn't understand is the impact on the banking system, particularly the regional banking system. And so here we are sitting here today, and we have various things going on, clearly. Started really with supply chain issues, the war in Ukraine, the Fed taking a particularly brutal, if you will, approach to tightening monetary policy, raising interest rates, all to curb the inflation issue, slow the economy, and so on. And the rate hikes have been that. They have been brutal, they have been vicious, they've been rapid, and they have been in orders of magnitude that none of us would have expected. We didn't really expect that the regional banking system would have gotten this completely wrong. And in some sense, the regional banks were guided by the OCC, the regulators, and otherwise. And for them, in an interest rate environment that was basically zero, and for all intents and purposes, a lower interest rate environment for a long period of time, they put on assets, they acquired assets that were longer dated assets. Now keep in mind, these assets were treasuries. These are not going to default. These are high quality assets. However, when interest rates rise the way they did or have, on a mark-to-market basis, those assets in terms of valuations have declined significantly. The other piece of that equation we were not really expecting was the run on the banks. And the run on the banks is an interesting one, right? When you step back for a moment, and we're depositors, all of us, in the banking system, we're effectively lending the bank money. People view their savings accounts with the banks, really, I use this analogy, kind of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Food, shelter, water, a safe place to put your savings, right? This whole idea of the backstop of $250,000 by the FDIC is interesting, but it's not front and center on people's minds, particularly those that run small, medium-sized businesses and are running average balances of a couple of million dollars in these banks. So once the fear sets in, you get a run on the bank, the liability side is short-term. When we want our money, we want it now. Isn't that what we bet on with the banks? Is that what we're supposed to do, get our money back? Of course. However, the liquidation of the asset side, they couldn't liquidate them quickly enough and took these massive mark-to-market losses, which continued this vicious cycle. Staying with the banking problem for a second, the regional banks constitute roughly 70% of all loans in the United States come out of the regional banking system. This is a massive number, right? So if you have a manufacturing facility in Chicago, you're not borrowing from B of A or JP Morgan, you're borrowing from your local bank. And you have a great relationship with your local banker. That is the United States. That's the core of liquidity in the United States. So a couple of things. In my opinion, I was really happy that the Fed stepped in and backstopped the deposits. Because if they didn't, I think this would have been much more of a systemic problem running through the system. So that was a good thing. They also did another good thing, which was to open the Fed window and allow the banks to pledge their loans at par, not at a discount, to the Fed window. What a lot of people don't understand, though, because we remember this from 2008, 2009, where the Fed opened the window, but the cost of that borrowing was basically zero.
Sure.
Today, it's 5.25%. And the problem is that the loans on the bank's balance sheet is only yielding 3. So it's like buying an apartment building at a 3 cap and borrowing at 5.25. What happens is your return on equity gets destroyed. Okay, that's one giant problem. Second problem is, in talking to a friend of mine that's a CEO of a sizable regional bank, he said, look, Warren, it's not just that. It's the fact that we all have a large percentage of our book commercial real estate loans. We have tiers, tier 1 through 5, with tier 5 being non-accrual loans and tier 1 being the highest performing loan, 1-2-5 debt service coverage, 60% loan to value, a great loan. But with the skyrocketing interest rates, those loans now are less than 1-0 debt service coverage and are kind of like 90% loan to value. So they're having to move that into tier 2, tier 3 and hold, allocate, reserve a far greater percentage of capital against those loans. Now do the math, all right? You don't have to be a genius to look at this and say we have an issue. The issues are return on equity borrowing from the Fed window, at least they get liquidity, but it's at a bad price relative to the asset yield, reducing their market cap. Secondly, needing these, because of high interest rates, these loans are now inside of 1.0, they have to hold a lot more capital against these loans. So not only is this depleting their capital base, it's also the return on equity is also going down. And then the third factor is an increased regulatory framework. Now, what does that all mean, right? So what it means today is you're going to see, and we are seeing, a retrenchment in the banking system. So less investment goes along the lines of the Fed of tightening monetary policy, right? Slow down the economy. Don't have such loose money, monetary policy, and high interest rates should slow everything down. So that's obviously, you know, one big factor. So if we have tight monetary policy, you have higher regulatory framework around the banks, you have less liquidity in the system, that should be deflationary, right, for all intents and purposes. So what now happens with $2.5 trillion of debt coming due in the next 5 years, $400 billion of private equity sitting on the sideline looking to invest in commercial real estate once prices reset, that's another $1 trillion in commercial real estate demand for debt products. You've got a retrenched banking system pulling way back. You've got a regional banking system that is really having a tough time. Who is going to fill the gap? So this is a bit of a self-serving comment, but folks like Acor, the non-bank system will grow rapidly during this period of time. What I think is going to happen is we'll see some of the bigger banks provide more repo facilities to lenders like ourselves, and we will come in and de-risk the banks in a much greater way than we saw before. So I still don't think there's enough capital in the system, anywhere close in the system, to meet the demand for commercial real estate loans over the next 3 or 4 years. The great reset in valuations that we're expecting that will happen. Keep in mind, real estate valuations are highly sensitive to interest rates. It's almost impossible to say values are not going to come down as a general comment, but sellers have to recognize it, buyers have to recognize it, and then we're going to get a reset in valuations and it'll be a great time to come back in and lend. The $2.5 trillion question is whether or not the assets that currently sit on the bank's balance sheets, that both one, the regulators, and secondly, the boardrooms of the banks will allow those loans to be extended. Mm-hmm. If they don't, I really don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be a shit show. If they do, what does that mean to the liquidity of the banks? There isn't a magic wand you can wave, the Fed wand, and all of a sudden things are fine. There has to be a clearing out of the system in some way. So that's a fairly bearish view. But I do feel like it's an honest view, and I do feel like it's a real view.
Well, that's all the time we have for Real Talk. So thank you so much, Warren. Wow. I don't even know where to go from there. I had about 20 different questions percolating in my mind. We can spend the next 2 weeks covering it. I guess. All right. So you said how this affects Acor, because let's just talk about you, because that's why you're on the show, not to talk about me, but to talk about you. How has business been so far this year? Are you actively making loans? And how has the profile of your loans and the properties that you're lending against changed over the last 6 to 12 months?
Like everyone else in our shoes, deceleration in pipeline. January was basically dead. No activity, people wondering what will happen. We currently have about $1 billion in deals closing, but that is significantly slower than our average run rate in any given year. By and large, there's no liquidity for the office sector unless it's West Palm Beach, Miami, Dallas, migration markets, top quartile assets. And I think that will continue to garner liquidity. But by and large, no liquidity in that sector. So a deceleration, a slowdown deliberately. Part of this is we've talked about a bunch of liquidity related problems. The credit problems, a prolonged period of illiquidity or lack of liquidity will result in a credit problem. But also the changes in behavior will result in credit problems. A deceleration of the consumer's balance sheet and the corporate balance sheets will result in more of a recessionary environment. So people are cautious. So we've slowed down a lot.
Well, how about just the mere fact of there just being a lot fewer transactions for you to finance? I don't know what your pipeline is from acquisition financing to just refinancings, if you could talk about that.
So typically we're about 80% of what we do is new acquisition loans. Mm-hmm. That whole market is down 60%, you know, year over year.
So and that, by the way, that mirrors even our law firm of we're probably down 50-60% in transactional volume of billings and deal flow.
I think we're all speaking the same language there. The other problem that's out there is that borrowers don't want to borrow money at these levels. I mean, you know, we're doing a transitional multifamily deals, you know, with high single digit coupons. You know, that number was 3.5% a year ago. It's now 9.5%. And that's not a function of us trying to extract more alpha. It's really just a function of where the market is at.
Well, so you're saying borrowers don't want to borrow at that price, but they don't really have a choice for the type of product that you are, you know, providing.
I mean, that's right. So what's interesting about multifamily, though, is the golden goose is the agency financing.
Sure.
So what we know about the agencies, they're in the low fives, 5.25%.
Yep.
It's the best financing by 300 or 400 basis points. So look, for me, again, it's a bit of a selfish comment, but this is a very good time to be a non-bank lender. The yield rates that we can produce and the credit profile is better than it has been probably in my career. Having said that, transaction volume has slowed. And we're able to really do the deals we want to do, but not enough of them. I'd like to see more transaction volume. I would like to see more liquidity in the system, right? I'd like to see a more active banking system. Now, on that particular point, liquidity in the banking system is critical to a working economy. It really is. They're the bedrock of everything. In order, so I often ask this question is, how are we going to see more liquidity in the system? I think one of the ways we can see this is if the Fed just chills out a bit. And so bond buyers in the CLO market, CMBS, RMBS market can look at this and say, hey, man, if I buy a bond today, rates are going to stay within a range. They're not going to rise rapidly. And effectively, the inverse correlation between rising rates and value of a bond is just that. So if you're a bond buyer, you don't want rates to go up and the value of your bond to go down tomorrow. If we get this right and the Fed chills out for a bit and we get the bond buyers to come back in, you'll see the banks offload a bunch of product into the CMBS, CLO market, and other mortgage-backed securities markets and free up more capital so they can lend back into the real estate market. If that happens, we'll get cap rates, more visibility into cap rates and price discovery. And I think that would be the impetus at which more liquidity comes into the system and we start to accelerate again.
So you used the word brutal as it relates to the Fed's decisions of you know, how quickly and how much they've increased rates. Do you feel, in order to curb inflation? So in using that word brutal, are you suggesting that it just was too much too quickly and they should have not raised as much or do it over a longer period of time?
You know, the great thing about hindsight is it can make us all look smart, right? So we get to sit here and be, you know, Monday morning quarterbacks. But the Fed should have done something earlier. They should have increased rates at an earlier stage to soften this blow. But increasing, you know, rates 500 basis points on the base rate over a very short period of time is incredibly aggressive. And the repercussions of which we haven't seen entirely yet. We were blindsided by the regional bank problem, right? So what's next? So I've been a little bit concerned about the outlook over the next few months. I would have thought, based on peak inflation numbers at about 9% headline inflation last year, July, those numbers are around 5% now, that we've made a lot of improvement. But really, it's about core inflation. It's got a hard egg. Core inflation is around 5.5% right now. And that within core inflation, you have housing, you have a bunch of things, but really housing, labor, and so on. My hope is that we are seeing a softening in housing prices. I'm talking about rentals across the country. It is resulting into deflationary pressure, and it makes up about 30% of core inflation. If that is the case, then, and that plays through, we really need to wait a little bit to see what happens here. So the regional banking system, hugely deflationary because they got no money to lend. Secondly is housing prices have softened. Hopefully that is going to come out in the next run of core inflation numbers. And wage rates are sort of chilling out, but not as much as a bit of an outlier. And the Fed has been very clear on their policy. They're basically saying, until we get really a change in this whole on this data, we're not going to reduce rates. And so I don't bet against the Fed from my perspective. So my guess is what I want and what will likely happen are two different things. I want them to chill so we can get this sort of deflationary thing to settle in and get bond buyers to come back in, create liquidity in the system, and get some price stability. If they keep pushing rates, the banks are going to have to borrow money at a higher rate, and this whole thing just gets worse and worse.
Now, you keep talking about liquidity, and I assume it's debt liquidity, because from the equity side, all the private equity companies are sitting on the sidelines. They've raised massive amounts of money, even as recently as the last 6 to 12 months. They don't want, at least my clients that are in the private equity world, they don't want to transact today because they fear that if they buy something today in 3 to 6 months, it's going to be 10, 15, 20% lower. They're all looking for blood on the streets. They want to buy distress. So they're preserving their capital. The one area in our law business, in our firm, where we have been extremely active in the last 6 months has been in fund formation, whether it's debt funds or equity funds. That's telling me everyone's gearing up to go on a huge buying spree, whether it's the end of 23 or in 2024. So if all of this money is just ready, just bursting at the seams to be deployed, how much carnage will there be? Because at some point, someone's going to come into the system and say, I'm a buyer. And that will create an artificial floor. And we're not going to see the 2009, 10, 11, 12, when those 4 years, all I was doing were workouts, note sales, restructuring. And I haven't done much of that, if any, I mean, one off here and there, but nothing like I was like we were busy with in the late 2000s, early 2010s.
Yeah, I mean, you make a lot of good points there. I think the one is, and thanks for the clarification, from a liquidity perspective, there is a ton of dry powder, $400 billion of dry powder private equity looking to invest. The issue is that money wants to make it 20, right?
Right.
And we're talking about assets that yield a lot less. So they're sitting there anxiously wanting to invest, but the opportunity hasn't really presented itself yet because of the bid-ask spread, just one of the issues.
We call them window shoppers.
Literally window shoppers for now and until they can step in. So, you know, if someone's going to come in and take an asset and buy an asset with a 20% yield, it's going to imply a significant discount to value. The sellers are not ready for that. So there has to be a series of catalysts that happen that then force valuations to be written out and allow this liquidity to enter the system. I think for a debt provider, someone trying to get into the senior debt business, that is a very, very difficult thing to do. As somebody who's built these businesses before, I can promise you it's expensive, high barriers to entry, and you need a lot of capital to compete. There's a lot of folks forming equity with different theses, and I can see that play. Now, where is the distress really going to lie? My personal view is that this is going to look more like 1992 than 2008, somewhere in between. We talked a little bit about the regional banks and their issues they have. I can't come up with a solution in talking to some of my friends that run them that is a solution that is credible in the short term. So for these folks to create liquidity, they can't go out and they can tap the Fed window, but there's a limit to that because of the cost. They can't tap the public markets. They can't tap the unsecured markets necessarily. So the only way to a path to liquidity is to sell these loans at a discount. Now, what you are seeing in the banks is you're seeing them write down loans. Every quarter taking a write down on the loans because, and then you combine that with talk to some of our friends at, you know, Eastdil, Newmark, CB Richard Ellis, the loan sales kings and queens of the industry, and they'll tell you that they are overwhelmed with the broker's opinions of value. I think this is setting up for them to mark the assets to a level where they will in fact transact without taking a loss in that quarter or a big loss in that quarter to create liquidity, partly to survive and some to do quite well. So I think the distress is going to come through that. The second area I think of potential distress is those lenders that are really smaller debt funds that were 100% reliant on aggregating collateral on their CL on their lines with a viewpoint to a CLO exit at some point in 6 to 9 months. Well, the unfortunate news for some of those folks is that spreads have widened, the CLO market is not as liquid, and now they're upside down from a mathematical perspective on the yield on their loans. What are they gonna do when the line lenders say, hey buddy, you're overexposed to your line, get this stuff off my line now. The only way to do it is then go sell those loans. So I think that those equity players, call it 15% yield plus, are really going to come in and look for those opportunities or enter the space through the debt side of the business. And there's one other big area that is on my mind, which is to the extent this thesis around the regional banks is in fact true, there is a fairly high probability, 50%+, that a fairly large number of regional banks get taken over by the FDIC. And we go back to something that looks like 1992. So I do think patience is a virtue here. I do think that the guns are loaded. I do think there's a lot of intelligent people sitting out there. The yield rates are high. And maybe the assets don't trade to that level to enable the private equity firms to make 20, but it's certainly a very interesting opportunity for ourselves as Acor with a lower cost of capital and an ability to onboard a lot of loans that are potentially performing loans that we're buying at a discount. So I think we're going to see a lot of that, Andrew.
Yeah, I actually was going to ask you, I mean, what your reaction was a couple of weeks ago of Kennedy Wilson buying, what is it, close to $3 billion of paper from Pacific Western. I'm sure there are others that are going to be happening in the near future. So you guys are out looking to buy paper from regional banks?
We are. Ways to partner with them, maybe finance them, you know, solve their issues if possible. And if they're looking for a quiet sale, we're happy to buy them at the right price. I think that the banks made very good loans. These are not bad loans. They just got caught in a liquidity pinch. This is not a credit problem, it's a liquidity problem. The one thing that'll be interesting to watch, I mean, the Signature Bank thing, $60 billion, is so huge, it's almost superhuman. It's like crazy stuff, I mean, in terms of its scale. But when PacWest decided to take $2.7 billion and move it, it'll be interesting to see how other regional banks react to that move, because the stock market actually accepted that fairly well. They said, okay, good, they're doing something about it. They're creating liquidity. And I could be wrong, but I think they rallied on that day. If that's the case, and I'm a CEO of a bank, and I'm saying, I've taken these write-downs, I can move this, my stock price will trade up, I free up a ton of liquidity, and I live to fight another day, I think we could see that as the catalyst for a lot more loan sales. But we have to wait and see.
On our remaining time, let's pivot the conversation just for my audience who's out there, who's a potential borrower of yours. You know, the type of loans, you talked briefly about it, but if you can get into a little more detail, you know, the type of leverage and how that has changed over the last several months, the quality of the asset, maybe quality of the borrower, the asset classes that perhaps you're not going to go finance. I don't know about your view with respect to office and, of course, the downtown LA office market and the opportunities that are there. I know I'm throwing a lot out there, but how has the type of loans that you are making today, how are they different from 6, 12, 18 months ago?
I mean, more conservative. It's a lender's market. So a year ago, it was a borrower's market. You could run an auction and have 10 or 15 lenders show up for the same loan and negotiate terms. I don't think this is a short-term problem. I think this is a midterm problem where, as a borrower, it's going to be more difficult to obtain liquidity. In the office sector, there's almost no liquidity unless you're top quartile assets or recourse. And that's probably for good reason. Obviously, baby gets thrown out with the bathwater, so there's a bit of exaggeration there. But this, the structural problems there, change in demand, and I haven't even started talking about AI yet, but that impact on the employment base is potentially bad. So I think that sector is going to be difficult to create liquidity for sure. Across the other product types, multifamily, industrial, most liquid, just the rate of borrowing cost, because your base index is so much higher, is materially different. You know, you could borrow 3-3.5%, you know, a year ago. Now you're talking about 7-10% on very good real estate at 65% of cost. The good news for borrowers is, while that cost of capital is really high, the duration is short. So if you believe that the Fed starts to loosen monetary policy and we start to ease up here, there are real situations where, as a borrower, you're taking this expensive debt in the short term, but you can prepay it with great degree of flexibility. So it is a liquidity, but it comes at a cost. If I was a borrower today, look, my job as a lender is to be probably overly conservative, right? I don't get any upside, I only have downside. So when I think about, and we position our company and our asset management team, we have, you know, almost 40 asset managers in Dallas and a 31-person asset management team, origination team in 5 offices. They're all working together with our borrowers to come up with solutions to help them get past this liquidity problem. So we're on top of all of this stuff with the existing portfolio. We're calling borrowers, we're talking to them every day, day in, day out, and saying, look, you've got a maturity coming up, you know, let's give you an extension, but you've got to pay us down somewhat. Let's align interests and get this done. So I spend a lot of time talking to our larger borrowers and sort of sharing my advice with them. What I do share with them is, I think liquidity is incredibly important over the next 12 to 18 months. And if you like your real estate, that liquidity comes at a cost. But don't, you know, bite your nose off to spite your face, right? Be careful, be thoughtful. Think out 12, 24, 36 months, or even 5 years out. And the key to that is, make sure you have liquidity. Because God forbid you have a building that has a loan coming due, you get too cute, and the Fed raises rates again. We don't have an opportunity for more liquidity to pour in the system. Now you have a real problem, right? And your lender says to you, oh, sorry, you know, Andrew, I have this loan on a warehouse line. As much as I love you, I can't extend it because my warehouse lender won't extend it. So you have to pay me off. So you say, oh, well, I missed that window. So what I'm saying is, you know, think longer term, make sure you create a bigger moat around your assets from a finance perspective, over equitize if you need to, borrow more capital if you need to, just because this will go away. This will work through the system, but it could take 24 to 36 months to have that happen.
Well, you commented earlier where you're looking to see how the regional banks are going to react to all the maturities that are coming due in the next 12 to 24 months. You know, are they going to extend those loans? And so what is Acor's position? I know every loan stands on its own. Every borrower stands on its own. That's why you're getting ahead of it. no lender wants to take back real estate. You're not set up for that, but that is the ultimate hammer. To the extent you can talk about it, you know, what are your philosophies with respect to that?
You know, so it's a great question. So we originate all of our loans, right? So we deliberately make our credit decisions based on the quality of the borrower, the real estate, the markets, whatever else. And I will tell you, we do a lot of work with our borrowers. As you know, we've been in this business for 30 years. We know almost everybody. We've done business with almost everybody over the years. So we are deliberately making a decision to make a loan to you, right? So we think you are the best owner of that real estate, the best borrower. So our intention is to work with you to work through the issues. But at the same time, we are fiduciaries for our capital. And what we want and we look for is alignment. So, you know, if you're not putting more money into the property, if you're not funding the requisite TIs to go and lease the property properly, if you're not putting the capital in and you're cutting too many corners, we're going to look at that as a strike. And you don't want too many of those, clearly. But we will work with the borrowers to get extensions and terms so that they have liquidity to bridge this period of time. We're just really looking for alignment. And what that generally means in a modification is that the borrower comes to the table with some equity, and we say, look, there's a realignment here. We like our basis. This asset might be a little iffy or cuspy, but we have the best borrower. Let's give them term to push this issue out. And by and large, that concept has worked incredibly well, but it is reliant on the borrower coming to the table with more equity. During COVID, we've only foreclosed on five assets out of 21 billion. It's not a lot. So we do look to work with the borrowers and be constructive, but it's a two-way street.
Sure. All right. Final question here. I want to take you back to 8 years ago, 2015, when you founded Acor, and you commented on how challenging it is to set up a debt fund. And yet, I can't even tell you how many debt funds I formed for clients. And you know, for the most part, they've done well, whether it's in the small balance of 10 million or the mid-size balance of 20 to 40 million. And you guys, I know what are your minimums now, about 40 or $50 million loan size, right? Or maybe they're higher. So going back to 8 years ago, what did you see that was a void in the system as to why Acor needed to be created? And comment on just the number of debt funds, whether it's now pref equity or senior debt or stretch senior, that seemingly are getting created every single day. I mean, your competition grows, but yet you keep growing. So what does that speak to about this industry?
You have to go back to when we joined Barry at Starwood Property Trust and then grew that business from 760 million to 5 billion, 5.5 billion market cap over 4 years. The impetus for that was really Basel III Dodd-Frank, right? Where basically the regulators came in and said, hey folks, you took too much risk. You're a bank, okay? You're not supposed to be taking this kind of risk. And I thought it was a very good thing, fundamentally. That gave birth to Ares REIT, to KKR, Blackstone's, Starwood, all their debt business. So the non-bank sector, which today is growing in prominence, was really started then. And I view this time, period of time that we're in currently, as that 2.0 and maybe much bigger. So we talked about the supply and demand for capital imbalance. There's going to be much more opportunity for the non-bank sector. When we started Acor in 2015, we saw what we had done at Starwood, and we saw the success, and we saw the need for flexible balance sheet transitional debt. And the demand was there. And we said, we're going to jump in and do what we've done before, and this time just make it bigger and slightly different. Little did we know we were going to run up against even a bigger opportunity now in the private credit markets to grow the non-bank sector. And so I think the timing was good. And I think our positioning now from a selfish perspective couldn't be better in terms of the opportunity set we have.
Sure. Now look, you guys are one of the bellwethers of in the debt fund industry, and everyone just speaks so highly of you personally, of the company. I've seen you in action, whether it's talking about monetary and fiscal policy and very high-level professorial thoughts to rolling up your sleeves, going through documents and budgets and getting very granular to the price of countertops. So to me, you are one of, if not the smartest, and I'm not just trying to blow smoke up your ass here from my podcast, but you are, Warren, one of the smartest guys in our business. And yet, with that sexy accent of yours, you always deliver harsh news in such a, just such a professional, loving way.
That's so. Can you talk to my mother and tell her these things too? And my wife too.
Your wife, I would assume. For, no, but look, you're a busy guy. I know you're in the airport and you're heading back to see your family back down to Miami. So I wanted to thank you for coming on and just giving our audience just a sense, your sense of what's going on in the market in general and Acor specifically.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Bell, and you too deserve a lot of credit for what you've been able to do and your partners. It's truly remarkable. So this has been a great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
I appreciate it, Warren. All right, take care and safe travels.
Thanks, Bell. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.